Last year I gave a meditation seminar day here, so today we're extending that for many more days. But this evening, it's the first public talk for this trip of mine, and on the subject, I wanted to make the evening talks, which are open to in perspective. It's not that huge a problem. The life goes on. That's just like, say, when somebody dies. When somebody dies, people get so sad because it's someone close to you. You so hold it so close to you, you can't see anything else except the death of your cat, or your dog, or maybe your wife, or whatever. And it's so close to you, you can't see the perspective. When you put it where it belongs, yeah, that's the sad thing that's happened to you. What about all those other relations there who you need to love and care for? What about all those other people in the office or in the hospital where you're working which actually needs you? What about the rest of life? When you see the big picture, you find that you can't get so depressed, even like the loss of someone you love dearly doesn't affect you as much because you put the whole thing in its perspective. I'm not going to repeat it here, there's simply the two bad bricks in the wall, because people know that so much in Malaysia that they come to my monastery and say, where are the two bad bricks? I want to see the two bad bricks and take photo. There's another thing I was noticing. I gave a talk last night in Perth. Now, why is another reason why we get depressed is that we always like to collect all the pain and difficulty of the past. Because I've noticed, I've been to people's houses and seen the photographs which they put on their wall or on their shelves. And sometimes I've seen their photo albums. Now, we always have photographs, say, of our marriage. But how many of you have photographs of your divorce? You don't put that on the wall, do you? Then you have photographs of the little baby when they're just really born. But do you have photographs of them when they're in the hospital, sick, having an operation? You don't put that on the wall, do you? You have wonderful photographs of like mountains and waterfalls. But do you have any photographs, of like the rubbish tips? Because we have these big rubbish tips, in Australia. Well, when we recycle things, sometimes we have to actually take them to the recycling tip. And I've never seen anybody take a photograph of the recycling tip. Now, you go to beautiful places, but you don't go with your camera to the wall and take photographs down there. So why is that, that all the photographs we take of the happy moments, and then you take photographs of when you graduate from university, when your children graduate. I've seen so many photographs in people's houses of your children wearing the funny hats and the robe, getting a scroll from somebody else. But how many of you have photographs of you doing examinations? Well, weren't you in front of the computer? When it gets to photographs, we only collect the happy moments. But when it comes to what we remember, we only collect the unhappy moments of our life. So the photograph album we've got between our ears is very, very negative, which is why we get depressed. So what you actually remember, the things which you keep, sort of the keepsakes of your life, should be exactly the same sort of things you put in your photo album. This should be like the wallpaper on your computer, should be like the wallpaper in your mind. Just the beautiful and happy stuff. And this is actually how we actually develop this positive meditation attitudes from Buddhism, which actually work. We actually get happier because we keep the happiness. One of the other reasons we get depressed is because as human beings, we always like to receive criticism. But very few people know how to receive praise. Even, the good friend who was he was a president of the Young Buddhist Association of Malaysia for a long time before he moved to Sydney, Eng Kong Tan. He's a psychologist, a very, very good man. I was at a conference with him about 9 months ago over in Sydney, listening to his talks. He's very, very funny. And he was actually saying that recent research in psychology has proven that before someone actually can receive praise, before it actually gets in there, it has to be repeated for about 15 seconds before it's accepted. If you just say something, thank you, you're a wonderful person, that's a great thing you've done, they just don't hear. It doesn't go in. So look, if you want to say praise your wife when you go home, you know, because you had an argument, ghost come again. I think it's something to speak this Christmas. Okay. Anyway, here we go. So, if you're going to be praising your wife tomorrow, somebody doesn't like praising wives. If you're going to be praising your husband, you're a monk. That worked. Then you have to go on for 15 seconds, at least. So you go home and say, darling, you're such a wonderful, wonderful wife. I love you so much. And you're so good with the kids. You're great with the housework. I'm so lucky to have married you. Of all the people in the world, I chose you and you chose me. You're such a great girl. You're so beautiful and charming. And the way you look, I really like. And I think that you're a wonderful personality. 15 seconds. Otherwise, it doesn't get in. But you criticize her. You talk too much. And she hears it straight away. And she doesn't forget it. For years, you said, I talk too much. And that's the same with men also. We just have not been trained to accept praise, but we've always accepted criticism. And I'm no exception to this. There was an incident which happened a few years ago, which changed a lot of the way I look at my life now. And that was when I was awarded a medal in Australia for some of the community work which I was doing. It was a very prestigious award. So I had to go to this big ceremony, and you know, they gave me this big medal, had to hang around my neck, and I also had to give a speech, an acceptance speech. And the acceptance speech I gave was, I'm very honoured and flattered to be given this amazing award. But you know, I'm just doing my duty as a monk. I don't really deserve it because there's many other people in the community who work much harder than I do. And anyway, I could not have done that without all the other people who support me and who are behind me, who work behind the scenes. So, but thank you anyway. And because I got that medal 1 year, and they award it every year, I was invited to go to the awards ceremony for the following year. And the following year, there was a professor of haematology at our local hospital was given an award. And the reason was that, being a professor of haematology, he was dealing with a lot of people who had cancers. And he had noticed that the treatment was excellent. Radiation therapy, chemotherapy, surgery, except that they were going into the hospital and out without much care. And he realized that was not good enough. They needed something more personal and warm for these people going through very, very great traumas. So he decided to use his position in the hospital to clear out two or three rooms and to turn that into an alternative therapy center where any patient who was undergoing chemotherapy, radiation therapy, or whatever, could go there for free and get a foot massage, Reiki, homeopathy, acupuncture, anything. Especially if it was somebody just spending time with you, caring for you, like giving you a foot massage. Whether it works or not, is somebody actually caring for you for half an hour. And that had huge results in the increased recovery rate for people with surgery, of the greater remissions for people who are undergoing chemotherapy or radiation therapy. Simply adding that extra ingredient of someone caring for you after you've been through these very, very painful or unpleasant experiences like chemotherapy had a huge difference. And because of that, they decided to award him this beautiful medal. When I heard what he'd done, I got emotional. I thought, wow, what a wonderful person this was. I thought, isn't it great that there are some people like that who actually understand the needs of people who are suffering? But when he got up to accept his medal, his speech was, I don't know why you gave it to me. There were more people who worked much harder in the community than I did. And anyway, I could not have done it without all the people behind me. And it was my speech. But because I was now being objective and just sitting on a chair listening to this guy, I realized, why is it that I did not receive the praise a year before? Why is it that I just sort of pushed it aside and saying there's other people better than me, there's other people who have helped me and they deserve as much as I do? I was not receiving praise. That's one of the great reasons why people get depressed. They receive criticism and they don't know how to receive praise. As a result of that experience, I've been teaching so many people in Australia, the next time someone gives you an award, and you give your speech, the first thing you should say is, thank you, I deserve that. So the next time I get a medal, I go, thank you, I deserve that. And you go, why do people laugh at that? Because it's not done, is it? Next time your husband tells you, oh, thank you, darling, for that's a wonderful meal, I said, yes, it was, I worked hard on that, I deserve that. Receive the praise for goodness sake. Because if you receive the praise, actually that builds up this beautiful energy inside and you don't get depressed. And don't think that if you receive praise, you're going to get a big head. You don't get a big head, you get a big heart. Okay, another card. Three cards, they're still there. Be careful. They're probably parts of BHQ 112. Outside is a certain amount of bad karma. It's double bad karma because it's in a holy ground. So be very careful. AHF 8173, please move your car. BTV 6283, move your car. BHQ 1123, none of those cars are mine.
Stop this person. It's very sad.
Okay. First of all, it's not his karma. who is Hagar Carver, so it's not destined to be. But first of all, that when somebody actually says that, usually the relations or even the police intervene to protect him from himself. Because sometimes people get into crazy little states like that. And we all know it does pass, and so sometimes you have to put people, as they in a padded cell, some place where they can do themselves no harm. And if you can actually do that, they call that, you know, in hospital, so they put it on suicide watch. Yeah. Yeah, no, but usually they tell them, if I saw that on a Facebook page, straight away I'd call someone, I'll go there myself. Now, physically, and just restrain the guy so he doesn't actually do anything so stupid. Sometimes a physical restraint, because you know that the next day you probably have a totally different understanding about the problem. It does pass. Now look, now I had a girlfriend which I fell in love with when I was young. And now she dumped me. But you know, at the time I was very depressed, and we all are. But I look back upon it and say, thank you so much, girlfriend. If you hadn't dubbed me, I might be married to you by now. This would have been a happy month. Oh, thank you so much for dubbing me. If I saw her again, I'd say, oh, thank you. But at the time, you know, you look upon it and it looks really terrible. But with the perspective of even a week, you look back and it's not so bad. That's a simile of the hand. But, you know, it's always prevention is better than cure. And so it's actually to prevent people from thinking they're going to solve problems by committing suicide. I said, okay, man, you think you're going to solve your problems, you're going to make all these problems for the people in Malaysia, which that guy has done. It's saddened a lot of people. So remember, you're not alone in this world. What you do has a lot of consequences for other people. So you're committing suicide, how much are you hurting your mother, your father, your friends, even other people you never really realised cared for you? And when you think like that, you say, I just can't do that. There's heaps and heaps and heaps of other ways. If a person starts getting a bit sort of sad and depressed, one of the great things they can do is actually to do some community service. Because a lot of times when they think life is not worth living, all they need to do is actually to go and like volunteer in a hospital, in an orphanage, in an old people's home. There's always something you can do. But when you actually go and work in a place like that, you realize, my goodness, I'm needed. And for 2 years, when I was at Cambridge, I used to spend one afternoon a week volunteering in a hospital for the mentally disabled, mostly working with Down syndrome kids. I did the first maybe month because I thought it was a good thing to do. After that, it was just because I enjoyed it so much. I wouldn't give that up for the world. It was one of my partners I looked forward to. And the reason was because those Down syndrome kids taught me just how to communicate emotionally. But now I was an English man. English men are not very well developed in their emotions, most of them. No, there's one here actually, isn't there? I've got to be careful. Yeah. But these Down syndrome kids, when they see me coming, they race up to me and hug me. And you know, I was not homosexual, I was heterosexual. Being hugged by another man in public was embarrassing for me at first. But I realized the amount of love these kids had. And sometimes I'd come, I was in a bad mood, and they pick it up immediately. I couldn't believe just how emotionally sensitive these people were. Their speech was hopeless. They could hardly, you know, put a few sentences together. But emotionally, they were so acute. And that's actually, I was so impressed with that. That's why I learned a lot, how to actually relate with people. So I give them a huge debt of gratitude. So you find that when you go and do any community service, actually they're doing the service for you. You are learning and growing. You feel actually so good about yourself. You've actually done something, you've helped somebody. So a bit of community service, if you're feeling down and you feel that, you know, you're not worth anything, just go out there. Just so many old people, elderly people, sick people, lonely people.
You just need just someone to talk to.
And I'm saying the whole problem, solve the problem. People have done that, and they've done, gone to community service to get rid of their depression. And they've gone with community service for years and years and years and years and years and years and years. And one lady that she was told to go into the burns units of hospitals, the children's wards. There were kids who had to be in this isolation, usually for months, because the burns were so bad they went out, they'd all get infected. And so they had this sterile ward, which they were like imprisoned in. And this lady organized volunteers and visitors, new faces who were just going to read stories to the kids or play with them. And the kids loved it so much because they were isolated because of the burns. And the people who went in there, they loved it even more. It was a beautiful situation where someone had a great idea. And actually she was depressed. That's not suggested for her to overcome a depression. And it worked tremendously well. So look, if you lost your girlfriend, or lost your boyfriend, lost your job, just go out and do something beautiful and worthwhile. You find that little bump in the road of your life. When you look at the big picture, it's nothing at all. That makes sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, we've got another car question. A question for the car. A friend's husband demanded a divorce while she wishes to reconcile, but the husband seems insistent. Shall she pursue reconciliation or shall she release him? And she's also tired of cold feedback from her husband. Thanks, Adam. So in case of that, you just got to make a decision. If you really want the, if it's from the, obviously the wife, if the wife really wants to make it work again, it's amazing that sometimes you can make it work again. Another old story, if I've told this for a while, this is one of the disciples in Singapore. She was a marriage counsellor, and she told this story. This woman came up to her, and she said her husband, she was sure her husband had a mistress. He'd been coming home late from work, and always been very cold to her, and never sort of saying a kind word to her. So now it's her who wanted a divorce. So she went to the marriage counsellor to say, shall we get a divorce? And the counsellor said, does he love you? Of course not. Well, look, if you get a divorce now, you're doing exactly what he wants. Are you happy with that? No! I'm not going to do what he wants. Exactly, said the counsellor. So what I want you to do is make him fall in love with you again and then divorce him. Yes! And that was the plan. And of course it wasn't that hard. You know, just that she started, you know, got a sexy hairdo, started wearing some, you know, more sort of revealing clothes, you know, makeup, perfume. There's no end of stuff you can do. That's half the economy is, you know, trying to sort of attract the other sex. And so anyway, she started dressing up, being kind and using her charms on him. And she'd go to the counsellor every week to give a report. And it's actually working. He was coming home earlier. And then he's giving her a hug. And then he's giving her a kiss. And then, you know, it was actually working. And then, is he falling in love with you yet? Not quite yet, keep on going. Because that's our plan. As soon as he's really in love with you, we'll divorce him. He deserves it. And then she's not coming for a couple of weeks. And so the counselor ran, oh, you missed two appointments in a row, what's going on? Oh, no, it's okay. No. Has he fallen in love with you? Yeah, he's fallen in love with me now. Great, divorce him. Oh no, he's so nice. And the counselor said, mission accomplished. Because that's the plan all along. The counselor never wanted them to get divorced. Now, this hurting the husband in that way was just a way of showing her that she could make him fall in love again. I mean,
I'm a monk, how do I know about these things? But you know, I've listened to so many people. One of the most important things in a relationship, in a marriage, is that the other person cares. He really cares for you. And he can do that. So after a while, you know, we don't care enough about each other. We just take each other for granted. And if you really care, I mean, you get that care up and you express it in words and in actions, you can turn your relationship around. That's the most important thing. Even in Singapore some years ago, I was teaching in the youth camp, and I just split the boys and girls into two different groups. And I asked the boys, these are about 18 to 20, 22 maybe, and I asked them, I said, well, what do you like in a girl? What sort of girl do you want to spend time with? And of all the qualities, you know, being beautiful or being sexy, that was actually down the list. They wanted a girl they could trust, and they could care for them. You know, all the girls were listening intently as I said this, because they wanted to know what they had to do to attract a nice guy. And then I asked the girls, well, what terms do you want with boys? What type of boy do you want? It's exactly the same, someone they can trust and care. And there's a wonderful little exercise there, because all these other things which we think are going to make us attractive, you know, sort of grey hairstyles, you know, design and clothes, they weren't that important. Now they were important, but not that important. What was most important was that people would care and look after each other. And so that's actually how relationships work. So, you can if you want to, but you know, sometimes that we know our limitations and we think, okay, that's enough. So, what is nice, if you are going to split, please split without any guilt. It's nobody's fault. This sometimes happens, it's impermanent, it changes, it won't last, this too will pass. If that's the case, I don't think it's his fault. Well, if it's a woman, she usually thinks it's her own fault. You start feeling guilty. And that helps no one at all. So if you're going to split, remember split in a nice Buddhist way. In other words, yes, we have a wonderful time together. It's anicca. It's not your fault. It's not my fault. We've drifted apart. It's common. It happens in life. It's not sort of our destiny. So that way we can actually split without recrimination. But it has to be very clear. Because the problem is, as you all know, when one person has this hope, well, maybe she really does still love me, maybe it really isn't all over, please make it very clear so both sides know that this is over, it's it. Finished. Because otherwise, if there's any lingering hope on one side, that's just really unfair. It just ruins a lot of life. So there you go. A monk has never been married. Sober for 36 years, and that's all about marriage. Any other question now? So what's coming up? Yes, go right over there. A live question, first of all. Yeah, I can move away from your heart. Yeah. Be ready.
Hello. Hi. Ajabra. Someone is very negative and you're keeping supporting, like giving positive emotion, positive thoughts and positive speech to them, and they are still craving for more, and you feel yourself empty inside sometimes and felt depressed because you can't help others to be nice to you. How to deal with myself?
Okay, good. Remember that you're trying to help other people. And if you really get depressed when you're helping other people, then you really depress other people, and both of you will start helping other people. Which is why all counsellors need another person to counsel. Or, if you're very, very wise, one of the tricks which Ajahn Chah taught me is very effective, which is why I've remembered it, is if you're a counsellor, or if you're just a good friend, and you have to be like a dustbin, like a trash can. You just listen to all their negativity and all their sort of pain and all their complaints. So they've just got to dump in you. The important thing is for you is to be in a trash can with a hole in the bottom. So you don't keep anything. So then they unload on you, they vent on you, they dump on you. Yes, 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 yes. But then when you walk away, you don't keep anything. Because otherwise, your own trash can becomes full. And then you feel depressed too. So that's actually why we should have a pretty good training. At least be wise when we try and help others. Otherwise, we might get in the same mess. So you count as well. That's why you know, always take a bit of time out for yourself. Get positive reinforcement for yourself. So you come to like a retreat like this and get full of energy and positive reinforcement, you come share it with your friends. But when you get sort of like a car, when you run out of gas, you have to come back to the temple to recharge.
Is
there
Can I
help? Yeah, please.
Is it I'm craving to see positive change in others? That's why it
depressed
myself.
It's not really craving to see positive change in others, that's just kindness. We want to sort of help other people. And that's just by helping other people, we actually would like to see some improvement. But sometimes we have to be very patient. Sometimes it takes a long, long time to plant a tree. And sometimes the trees which I've helped plant, I won't see them grow in my lifetime. But I know, other people will. You will, but I won't. But it's still worth doing. So sometimes some of the seeds which I've planted, either in people's minds or in other areas of life, it won't grow in my lifetime. It's still well worthwhile doing, because someone else will see it grow. Oh, we got a question here. Here you go. Ajahn, just now you mentioned this will pass. While waiting for this to pass, what should we do in the meantime? Very good question. Is it? Old Buddhist story, and it's a classic one, about the guy who was being chased by a tiger. And the tiger was catching up on him, and he was running for his life, and the tiger was even getting closer. And out of desperation, he managed to see a hole in the ground, a well, and he jumped in the well. It's either that or get eaten by the tiger. And as soon as he jumped in, he looked down the bottom of the well. There was a big black snake. It was a dry one. And instinctively he reached out the side and grabbed hold of a root which was coming out of the wall, and it stopped his fall. And when he came to his senses, he looked down, and all the noise had woken up the snake, and the snake had lifted its head, opened its at his feet. And his feet were just too high. The snake was stretching to try and bite him, but they couldn't. It was just too high. So he looked up, and the tiger had given up. The tiger was leaning into the well, trying to paw him from above. And his hand was just too low, and the tiger couldn't reach him. So there he was, between a tiger and a big black snake, wondering what to do next. And then he saw the next thing which happened. But two mice came out from a hole in the well, a black mouse and a white mouse, and they started chewing his root, making it thinner and thinner and thinner. It's not going to last that much longer. And the next thing which happened, the tiger was stretching even more to try and paw him. So the back, the hind quarters of the tiger was rubbing against the tree, making it shake. And on a branch of that tree, overhanging the well, was a bee's nest. The bee never came down, but the honey did. And he put out his tongue and enjoyed the honey. It was so tasty. And that was the end of the story. And that's what we do. We're waiting for this to pass. To enjoy the honey which is always dripping down from somewhere. So there you are. You're liable to be depressed, aren't you? There's a snake underneath you, a tiger above you, and your precarious hold on safety is being eaten by the mice. But it doesn't matter. Always enjoy the honey which is dripping down. That's nice. So, when you're waiting for this to pass, have a nice, delicious cup of coffee. Have your favorite food. Whatever else it is, this is delicious. Because you don't know what's going to happen next. And in my ending of that story, which I wrote in Opening the Door of Your Heart, and it could happen, it's logical. In my ending of the story, the tiger stretched a little bit too far, lost its balance, and fell into the well. It missed the guy, but fell on top of the snake, crushing the snake and breaking its own neck. There are both dangers that both died. He could actually climb up out of the well at his leisure, which he did. And so often in life, we miss the chances of enjoying the honey. We were so worried about things which weren't a problem anyway. Isn't that the case that sometimes your life is like being between the snake and the tiger? The black and white mice are night and day, always chewing away at your precarious hold on safety and health. And what do you do? Taste the honey and enjoy it. That's nice. So that's what one does. There's lots of honey around. Okay. Any other questions? On the talk this evening? You know, whoever asked those questions, they were really wonderful questions. So, you know, well done. That's a great question. So what should you say?
Thank you.
I deserve that. So I came in the heaven. I've got many of my disciples going to the heaven of doing that in Australia. When they receive praise, they say, thank you, I deserve that. And people laugh at first, and then they get the point. And so often we just aren't allowed to say, I deserve that, to accept praise. So, that's nothing. Oh, it's okay. It's not nothing. Someone has actually appreciated you. You know, to get my medal, it has a whole committee. Had to look into everything I had done and what other people have done and decide, yes, this year we're going to give it to Alexander Brown. When I say I don't deserve it, I say, all you committee people are wrong. So now, when I get a medal, I'll get praise, I say, thank you very much, I deserve that. It makes life much more fun, so you don't get impressed. Any other questions? If there's no questions, could be helped. Okay. We have to be not many wise people in this question. How to calm and how to lift up the spirit of someone who's diagnosed with terminal illness so that person's able to face what comes more calmly? It's wonderful that you're terminally ill, because each one of you is terminally ill. You've got a disease called life. I read that in an Australian book, The Definition of Life. Life is a sexually transmitted terminal disease. Thank you, isn't it? So when you're terminal ill, hey, I'm out of here. Because look, if you're not terminally ill, you're going to spend all these years in a nursing home. Have you been in nursing homes? It's not very pleasant in a nursing home, is it? So if you've got a terminal illness, that's the first benefit. You don't have to go to a nursing home. Especially if you're young, anyway. That's why they're using me in a terminal illness. And number two, you've got a terminal illness. This is what the Buddha, when he put in meditation, one of the Devadutas, the messengers of God, you know, I'm going to die. It's a wonderful thing to know that. There was this guy I mentioned, he was a friend over in Sydney, And he would have his annual medical checkup, and one day it happened, his doctor called him, after called him at home, just a couple of days after his checkup, because his doctor was a personal friend. The first thing the doctor said was, "Is your wife at home?" If your doctor rings you at home and says that, you know you're in big trouble. What's wrong? And the doctor said, "Look, you're a friend. I'm not just your doctor, I'm your friend, so I thought I'd better tell you this personally. The blood tests have come back from the lab. You've got a cancer, a blood cancer. It's a rare form of cancer, but it's terminal and untreatable. I'm sorry." This is a real story. And this guy was just shocked, because when these things happen, they are balls from the blue, totally unexpected. He thought he was healthy. Of course, the next thing you ask, usually the next thing you ask is, how long? How many months or years have I got? It's like that story of one of the other guys who went to see the specialist, and he said he got cancer, terminal disease. And the man asked, "How long have I got to live?" And the doctor said, 10. He said, 10 what? You know, 10 days, 10 months, 10 years? The doctor replied, 9, 8, 7. That's a terminal disease. So this doctor said, "Look, this is a real story." He said, "No, you can't say, but I'd expect maybe 2 months, 3 if you're lucky, probably not 4. And that was just really tough to know. He only had a couple of months to live, or 3 at most. So he thanked the doctor for being upfront, being clear. He talked it over with his wife, cried a bit. But then he decided, like many people do, he spent all his life being busy, and he often promised his wife and kids to go to Europe for a holiday. But you know, never found the time. That happens in life. We make all these promises, but business and other things get in the way. But now he was going to die in a couple of months. He sold his business. With the money, this was the last chance for him and his family. He actually bought first class tickets. When you're going to die, the money doesn't have any meaning anymore. So he bought first class tickets to go to Europe for his wife and kids. And apparently he had them in his hand when the phone rang again. It's a true story. The doctor said, "I don't have to tell you this." Two patients, same surnames. We mixed up the results, you're perfectly happy. And that friend was so grateful for that experience. He calls that doctor like his teacher, like his spiritual master. Because he went on that trip to Europe with his family, had a wonderful time, still had enough left to actually buy another little business. And he changed his whole life and became this wonderful father and husband. Because he had came that close to death, he thought he was going to die. And that taught him the meaning of life. That's what terminal illness does to you. It shows you what life really means and what's really important in life. And you don't know that until you've had that experience. So, terminal illness can be this wonderful gift of understanding how important life is and what life is all about. And those last days, weeks, maybe months can be the most beautiful time. I always say, because I live in Western Australia, we face the Indian Ocean. The most wonderful times of the day at sunsets, when you see the sun go down over the ocean. It's the end of the day, the most beautiful part of it. It's like the last part of a human life. It can be the most beautiful. It's like the last part of a symphony. For those of you who like classical music, when all the different themes come together, it's so thrilling. The
very end, before the symphony finishes, and you leave so enhanced and gifted that you were there to listen to that great music. That's what I call life, the great concert, which is usually reaches its peak and most beautiful part in the end. Terminal illness. You were born with a terminal illness called life. So when it actually is happening, you can tell them this is a beautiful time. Make the most of it. It's the sunset. It's the end of the concert. The most beautiful part. And then you just look at this in a totally different way. So many Buddhists are like that. You all know the chief reverend. You know, Vic Fields, you know, the former one who just died. And you know, hopefully you've seen his autobiography or the story that when he was diagnosed with terminal cancer, what did he do? He laughed. And the doctor, the oncologist, said that's the first time I've met anybody when they're told they've got a terminal illness, first start laughing. So that's what I would advise you to do. Wow! You can do that if you're wise. That's my deal with terminal illness.
Laugh your head off.
So, any other questions about that's the sort of things you can tell me? Yes?
Good evening, Ajahn.
Good evening.
So happy to come to your meeting.
Very good. Thank you. That's a wonderful question, and actually, I deserve that praise.
I would like to request that you relate about the stories of the two fabrics. Because it's very significant, I think, because I was supposed to be my son and my granddaughter.
Okay.
Okay.
And actually, the story of the two bad bricks he requested, and it is true that I do change the stories because I believe in evolution. So the bricks actually change, you know, with every telling of the story. So this was when I first went to Australia, and we were so poor as monks. No one was supporting us at all because they didn't know who we were. You know, were we sort of some con men? You know, were we just, you know, wearing these strange garments and robes? They didn't know who we were. So, of course, they wouldn't give any donations. So we really had to work hard in those first years. We managed to buy some land with a lot of loans. You know, if that credit crunch had happened sort of when I first went to Australia, we would be in big trouble. We'd have gone down too, but we had lots of loans. When we did get any money, we couldn't afford to hire a builder. So it was me. I had to learn how to build. And remember, I was a theoretical physicist before. Theoretical physicists, we don't stay in little studies and just write unintelligible symbols called maths. And that was my speciality, not building. But I had to learn. I've always had this positive attitude. You can do whatever you want, you can learn anything. I remember this guy who was about 50, and he learned how to play a cello. And in a few years, he was actually playing in the orchestra. I thought, well done, it doesn't matter you're 50, you can't learn new things. Keep on going, try it. And this is, and I look at the university where I got this medal, there was a guy who was 80 who was doing a bachelor's degree. Well, why not? He's hanging around with all these 18, 19-year-olds, having a great time. But anyway, so I had to learn how to build. So I had to lay concrete, lay bricks as well. Now, this was the first time I'd laid a brick. So you know, you mix up the mortar, you lay the mortar down, you put the brick on top, but it's never level at first. Because the mortar's not level, so you have to tap it down, tap it this way, tap it that way. Whichever way you tapped it would never come out right. So you take it off and start again. It was painstaking. But the one thing which a monk has, we've got patience. It doesn't matter how long it takes, one brick a day.
that'll do. So it was so patient until he got the hang of it. Because every brick had to be perfect. And when I sort of saw a brick which was not perfect, I'd take it out and start again. And that's how I built my first brick wall. Unfortunately, when the brick wall was finished, only then did I stand back to look at it, to admire my handiwork, as you all would do. And that was when I saw the two crooked bricks. All the other bricks were perfect, but these two were at an angle. They're like leaning tower pizza. Not pizza, sorry, pizza. I always thought that's where pizzas came from, in the leaning tower, but they said, no, pizza and pizza is a different name. But anyway, it was really these two bricks were leaning over, and the thing was, they spoiled the whole wall. And because it wasn't perfect anymore, these two bricks right in the middle were standing out. So what did I do? I tried to scrape out the mortar. But it was rock hard. I couldn't do that. So I thought, what else could I do? I know what I can do. Blow it up and start again. So I actually did that. I asked the other man with me, have you got enough money to afford some dynamite? Blow it up, start all over again. But of course, that wasn't allowed. So there I was, stuck with this wall, which everybody could see, with my mistakes right at the center. And I was so upset about that, depressed about that, that I would think about that, I would dream, I'd have a nightmare about that, you wake up in the middle of the night and think, I was stuffed up, I should have done that, I wasted people's money. And even that I was volunteering for about 3 months, to being the tour guide, any visitor who came to that monastery, I would volunteer to take them around. You know, so I could take them somewhere else so they wouldn't see my mistakes. That's the only way I could control it. And it was only after 3 months that I was with a visitor and they saw that wall and they remarked, that's a beautiful wall. And of course, I couldn't believe that at all. What the heck are you saying, it's a beautiful wall? So I replied to them, now, have you left your glasses in the car? Are you blind? Can't you see those two bad bricks? And they replied, yes, I can see the two crooked bricks, but I can also see the 998 perfect bricks as well. And that really shook me, because I realized that for 3 whole months, I would only see the two faults. I couldn't see anything else except my mistakes. Literally, every time I went past the wall, my eyes went to just the two bricks. Every time I thought about it, I thought about those two bad bricks. Every time I dreamed about it, I dreamt of my mistakes. And that guy said there was other bricks in the wall other than my mistakes. There's other parts of my life other than being dumped by the girlfriend. When I actually saw the 998 good bricks, well, they were there all the time, but because we had fault finding mind, you couldn't see them. The brick above, below, to the left and to the right, and all around. I realized, my goodness, that guy was right. It was a beautiful brick wall. I'd actually done a very good job. But because I was focused on 2 mistakes out of 1,000, I'd actually wanted to destroy that wall. Blow it up. Just as that poor young man, because you know, he had trouble with a girlfriend, and that's all he could see, he destroyed his whole life. He couldn't see the 998 other bricks in life. And that story has helped so many people. Stop them getting divorced. Okay, so your husband's committed adultery. How many times hasn't he committed adultery? good bricks to 2 bad bricks. Is that really worth it? If he's got 998 bad bricks, okay, it's only 2 good bricks. Why do we keep destroying life? So that was a simile of the 2 bad bricks in the wall. There was this...
Thank you.
Okay, very good. It's just like I remember going to Singapore during the SARS crisis. You remember the SARS crisis?
was actually quite surprised because at KLIA this afternoon they had the heat sensors. Is there some other sickness going around? There's a bird virus, isn't it? H1N1. Bird flu. Okay, what's one right at this? Swine flu, bird flu, pig flu. Anyway, the SARS crisis. The people over in Singapore, the Buddhist Fellowship, had actually hired Suntec City Auditorium. And that's actually when they advertised on the back of the buses. So it's actually really amazing that, you know, I went to Singapore and actually behind the public buses there's a photo of me advertising, you know, come to my talk. Because I don't know if you've heard this saying before, but there's a very common saying in the West that you've got a face like the back of a bus. Anyway, it's advertised. So they spent, you can imagine how much that costs. They're putting advertisements on the back of buses. And they've hired, you know, this convention centre there with about 5,000 seats. And that was the very height of the SARS crisis. I remember, you know, on the aircraft going over, they had a copy of the Straits Times. And there was, in black, on the front cover, 99 dead. That was the death toll that morning. And all the organisers were waiting for me. I actually passed through the sort of the heat sensor. They were waiting for me on the other side, really, really concerned, because the government had closed all the schools and they're advising people to have no public meetings. They couldn't force that, it was just advice. So they came up to me and said, "This is terrible, should we cancel?" You know my response? I said, "How many people in Singapore?" I said, "I think about 4 million, they said at that time. So, well, that means that 3,999,901 haven't died of SARS. Actually, no, they hadn't died, but they got SARS, confirmed cases. So look, 3,999,901 haven't got SARS, 99 have. So what's the odds of getting SARS? When I put it that way, he said, "Oh, that's true. Let's go ahead." What do we think, 99, that's all we see, the two bad bricks, and of course we want to cancel. When we get the big picture, of course we know it's a stupid thing that we don't want to cancel. And anyone, I said, look, at this particular time the people need this most of all, because SARS, it was a respiratory disease. And you come to one of my talks and people laugh so much during the talk, it actually strengthens their lungs. So it's actually a great sort of better antibiotics. And of course, none of the people who came to my talk got SARS. Mission accomplished. So that's one of the two bad bits in the world. It's a very good story because so often we just see the faults, see the mistakes, and we just react to the mistakes rather than seeing everything else which is about those mistakes. So thank you for letting me tell that story of the two bad bits in the world. It's a very, very good question. So well done, sir. Did you say I deserve that? Yeah, okay, well, yes. Okay. How meditation helps relieve depression. This is an important aspect of meditation, which I know you've heard before, but many of you may not know that this is actually what Ajahn Chah used to say this, and I know this is a very important fact, that if you want to have a healthy body, you've got to exercise it, you've got to move it, you can't just sit still, otherwise the body is not healthy. But if you want to have a strong mind and a healthy mind, you have to keep it still. So if you exercise the mind, thinking this, worrying about that, you get a weak mind. If you keep it still, you get an incredibly powerful, strong mind. And that's Ajahn Chah saying. It's reflected in the teachings of the Buddha as well. So what meditation means is keeping things still.
so things aren't moving. And then you get this incredible boost of energy. That's actually one of my tricks. Because you know, just what have I done? I've been traveling all morning. I got up about 3:30 this morning, your time. So I had a shower, got myself ready, traveled to the airport, and got on an aircraft and just flew first to Singapore and then Singapore over to KL. So that's what I've been doing all day. Do I look like I'm tired? And sometimes I go like this for days and days and days. I remember on this one occasion that I had again, it was in Singapore, they're having this concert. So I rushed as soon as I could to get to Singapore, and then we did the straight from the airport, straight to the concert hall to do a little concert. I was just appearing as myself, of course, just giving a talk. And anyway, after the first performance, I gave it everything I've got, and I was exhausted after that. Just want to go to bed and sleep or something. And everyone else went out for dinner. And of course, that's hopeless for me. I can't eat anything after 12. So what I did, I found a quiet place in the theatre. It's just one of the doors which was locked and a little passageway going there. I just went there to sit meditation. Because I know I can get my mind still very quickly. When it becomes absolutely still, this huge energy comes up. And after that boost of energy, well, I was on fire the second performance that evening. And all this energy coming up. And this is actually how I just energized myself, to perform. Sometimes I should be tired and should be really exhausted. Because I know from stillness you get huge energy. But through activity, you just lose all that energy. And if depression is a low mental energy state, which it is, it's got no energy left. Just you don't even think. You just can't think. What you see is all grey. You mean what you taste. It's got no taste to it at all. Just life is just bland. Just because you haven't got any oomph or any energy in your mind. You can keep it absolutely still. Or even not absolutely still, but a little bit still. Not worry, not try and get out of depression, not try and do things. But preserve your energy with stillness. And all that energy starts coming back. You literally wake up. Your back becomes straight. Your mouth becomes turned up at the sides. You've got energy, and you're happy, and your depression is gone. So it's actually understanding from stillness you get mental energy. And mental energy is the best antidote to depression. So actually that's how it works. It's a law of nature of the mind. And if you really get into this meditation retreat, as happens very regularly in the retreats I give, sometimes you sit here at 10 o'clock and you just don't want to go to bed. If you do, you can't sleep. Not because you are thinking on it, because you're so still, you've got this huge rush of energy. It's so comfortable, so nice, and so beautiful, you're having a great time. Where does that energy come from? You don't need to sleep. Why? Because you're still. And hopefully some of you will get to those experiences, what meditation does for you. You just get so still, so energized, so beautiful. You don't need much sleep at all. If any. And you're just so positive and happy. So yeah, that's actually how it works. And many of you will find out, those lucky enough to be joining this retreat, here at Watch Theatre One, you lucky things. For those only coming for the evenings, never mind, next time. Anyway, next question. Or any other questions?